are things going, man? It's been a little while since we caught up.
Things are going well. Things are moving. You know, everything kind of ebbs and flows, goes into kind of peaks and valleys. But for the most part, things have been moving in the right direction. I would say it's been somewhat, you know, following what's happening in the market and, you know, just in our economic environment, because that's where I'm focused at the moment. But things have been going well. Things are definitely looking up. I can assure you of that.
Yeah, no lie. Well, just before the beginning of the year, you were doing a lot of international travel. Well, so what was all that about?
Yeah, a lot of the, you know, there's a lot of activity happening, particularly for me in Latin America. There's a drive of entrepreneurship that's similar to, I would say Silicon Valley was kind of in the dot-com era. And what's happening is in places that you wouldn't normally think in Latin America, they're actually growing so fast. I never thought I would see a unicorn necessarily in Ecuador, but there is.
Okay. Right?
So a lot of people wouldn't you know, necessarily think of it in that way. A lot of people think of Latin America as, you know, high risk or, you know, for investing or otherwise. But there's a lot of growth. There's a lot of innovation happening. And, you know, all of that travel that you saw me doing was really around capturing a lot of that activity. And what's really interesting about that is that all of the experience that I had at GE, all the experience I had in corporate America, you know, and really seeing the different geographies around the world has really brought all of that together. Because some of the conversations, they start out kind of like consulting almost. What do you think? Have you seen this before? What are some of the other regions you've seen it before? It kind of starts out that way. But then all of a sudden, you know, it starts to really kind of culminate and materialize into a really good opportunity. Either that company will go forward or that leader will go forward, or they're asking me to be involved. So that's what was pulling me into a lot of that travel that was happening at the beginning of the year.
That's wild. That is wild. Well, I guess, you know, it's funny because you were talking about going back to your days at GE. And when I look at your history of growth and what you've done over the course of your career, right? You started out at Mississippi State, you were playing football and getting a degree in mechanical engineering, which is no small feat, right? And then you go in to be a project engineer, then you start leading sales, leading functionals, you become a GM for you know, a functional element within GE across a $15 billion group of businesses, which is crazy. And then from that, you decide to make a hard pivot, right? And go join a couple other companies, get some more successes under your belt, and then start up your own firm. So quick question for you. When you go back to your days at GE, how do you go from being a field engineer to running a functional business unit across, you know, a $15 billion group of businesses? That doesn't just happen unintentionally.
Yeah, you're right. And it was an exciting ride, I can tell you that. You know, it's one of those what they call pivotal moments, right, in your career. And, you know, a lot of times it happens early in the career, and hopefully you're fortunate enough to take advantage of it when it does happen. But there's a couple things during that time, you know, being field engineer and kind of moving up the ranks. One was, you know, there was an opportunity as I was a young engineer, we'll call it. A lot of the issues that we would see in trying to execute upon some of the projects that we were doing, a lot of the issues were coming around supply chain, parts supply chain. We actually, at the time, we called it the parts center. So it was kind of like the black hole. Parts were always late, never on time, always the wrong parts, right? So I saw an opportunity to where, you know, I had a chance to go work for the parts center. So it was one of those pivotal moments to where I went to the dark side, if you will, early in my career. But by doing that, it really gave me a chance to see how the business worked, because when I was in the field, we only saw one side of it. We didn't see the downstream supply chain issues that were happening. So that was one of the things that really, I would say, was a pivotal moment for me to kind of see not just what was in front of me, but to see kind of the whole business and how it operates. The other, you know, early on in the career, the other pivotal moment for me as well was, you know, when I would go out to these field engineer jobs, I would always come back to the home office and decisions would have already been made, right? So, you know, I go out for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever, and I come back, this person's moved on. I go out for another 6 weeks, 8 weeks, I come back, this person's left, right? Or they've changed, you know, something that was happening in the office. And I remember coming back and I said, you know, I love what I'm doing, but I would also love a seat at the table. Whether that's in a junior role, whatever role that is, because every time I come back, there's something different. And I feel like I just felt like I was being left out. So I actually asked for a seat at the table. And that's where the regional leadership, you know, kind of came into play, you know, pivoting from the part role that I took, but, you know, leading a whole region of part salespeople. And then you take, you extrapolate that from the region level up to, you know, the national level up to, you know, the global level. So that's really how it started.
Yeah. And well, and I think one of the things that you touched on, and if I use my words, it's you learned the power of perspective as you went through this, and that the visibility that you had on a particular issue may not be the full 360 view.
That's right.
On it. And you did that at a very early stage in your career. Because I know for me, it took me a while to learn that. I grew up in a family-owned business. And so I always kind of had an owner's perspective, which I always thought was like all-inclusive. And then I had to learn that wasn't the case.
Right.
Right? It was, you know, it was like, hey, the buck stops here. But even though the buck stops here, doesn't mean that you really understand the problem completely.
That's right.
Yeah. So I love that. But what, and the other thing that I heard you say as you were going through this was you saw opportunities come up and you took them, right? You weren't afraid to make a change with your career. And that's something that as I look back over the course of my career and people that I've known that I thought were excellent in what they did, but may have just stayed in that for their entire career, right? Some advice that I was actually given when I transitioned from small family business into corporate America was, they said, Mike, you could be the world's best product manager today, and 20 years from now, you'll still be the world's best product manager.
Yeah.
If you're not willing to change roles, change jobs, do new things, and take risks within the profile of the company. So how did you know what risks to take? If you think back on it and you said, hey, I took this role and that paid off, how did you decide what to do? Sometimes I've heard people say they followed people, right? They picked their leaders and their managers. Others said, oh no, I found a gap and I went to the gap. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Something nobody else wanted to do. How did you pick your opportunities?
You know, it's a very interesting question and very real. I would say, you know, for me, it was more around looking for the opportunity, and you know, whether that opportunity was immediately clear or not, wasn't always the case. And I had a mentor that told me, you know, he said, Michael, anytime you get into a new role and you're sitting at your desk on the very first day and you're trying to figure out, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? He said, that's when you know you're in the right job. Because from that day forward, you're figuring out how to do what you don't know how to do. And no matter what the result is, you're further down the road than you were. So that guiding principle, if you will, that I was able to, fortunate enough, able to get early on in my career, really guided me through to this day. Now, you know, so when I was seeing opportunity, the path wasn't always clear. But I would go take that leap of faith and go and understand that there was opportunity, but didn't know exactly what that looked like. And, but just having that comfort, if you will, that comfort in ambiguity, that you have to be comfortable in the uncertain to a certain extent, to be able to do that. But that's really, you know, one of the things that kind of helped, that it kind of helped me, you know, take some stretch roles. We used to call them stretch roles, you know, in GE. But even to this day, I mean, I'm stretching to this day. So what I would say to that is that when I was in corporate America, the steps, I would say the strides weren't as wide. The strides of uncertainty, they weren't as wide. Right, there were strides of uncertainty, but you were in a corporate umbrella, right? You can only probably fall so far,
yes,
because you had that corporate umbrella sort of around you. So
you're still going to get a paycheck.
You're still going to get a paycheck, right? So
entrepreneurship,
no,
not going to get a paycheck.
You're not going to get a paycheck. So that stride is longer, right? So when you're taking that leap of faith in entrepreneurship, that stride is significantly longer. And you definitely have to be comfortable with the uncertainty. You have to see the opportunity still. But you have to approach it in a way that, you know, obviously you're confident, but at the same time, you're open to learning new things, figuring new things out, knowing that you're not going to know everything, right? But have the ability to adjust and to adapt, right? So for me, I mean, when you talk about, you know, how did you know, or how did you navigate that? It really started out from seeing the opportunities and seeing the gaps, wanting to be different, and then having that mentorship to say, you know what, when you get in your first job, you don't know what you're doing, but you have a pretty good idea, but you don't know all the pieces yet. You're in the right spot because you're going to figure it out. And I can tell you, in entrepreneurship, you know, every day, you know, you're waking up trying to figure it out. You know, some days things come together, some days things don't come together they definitely don't come together as fast as you would like them to come together. They come together, but they definitely don't come together as fast, right? So that's what I would say to
them. Yeah, I love that. And it's one of the things that I've realized going from an entrepreneurial family to corporate America, back to entrepreneurship, is the thing that I loved about corporate America, and the thing that I didn't like about it was its certainty and consistency,
mm-hmm.
Right? Even the definition of risk, hey, we're going to take this big risk and we're going to do that. At the end of the day, you know, if it didn't work out and you did all the right things, the company would find a way to find you another role.
Right.
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 Because they were taking a calculated risk, and the only thing that was being risked was some cash off of the company's balance sheet.
That's right. Yeah.
And now if things don't go right, you know, people lose homes. They put their entire house on the line, right? Or their 401k or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's risk tolerance is a crazy part of it.
Yeah. I would agree. Just to, you know, kind of build on that a little bit, you know, once you do, right, on the entrepreneurial side, and once you do take that risk, once you cross that chasm, it's actually kind of hard to go back, right?
Yeah. Talk more about that.
You know, because it's almost like walking through a waterfall, right? You don't know exactly what's on the other side, but because you can't see it, right? But then once you walk through it and then you get to the other side and you see the sunshine and the birds flying, and you know what I mean? And not every day is going to be that way, but you're not going to walk back through that waterfall and go back to where you were because you're going forward. Right. So it's kind of one of those things where it is a leap. It is a leap of faith. You know, it is a big stride of uncertainty. But when things go, you know, things start to line up, and they do, again, you have to see the gap, you have to see the opportunity, then you have to be committed, you know, to going after that opportunity. Like you said, some people will put their house on the line, some people put their 401ks on the line. And once you cross that chasm, you can't go back. It has to work, right? And you'd be amazed at, you know, what you can do, obviously, when you have to do it, right? In corporate America, you don't really have to do it, right? You'll get a performance review, and, you know, instead of getting rated an A, maybe you get rated a B. And, you know, it's a while, right? You got at least 18 months.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And on the entrepreneurial side, you have a day, maybe a week, right? You know, it kind of get everything back on track. So it's different. You know, it's very different. And I talked to my friends today who are still in corporate America. And it's honestly a different conversation, but not in a bad way. But it's just different. We're having a different conversation. We look at things completely different. I can assure you, in the sense of, you know, how you look at opportunity, how you look at adversity, you know, the resilience around, you know, just hearing no's and, you know, getting setbacks or things not, you know, going your way. It's just different. The conversation is different.
Oh, yeah. And I think the other thing that is different is the speed of decision making.
Right. Yeah.
Is dramatically different. We both worked in very intense, frenetic environments in corporate America. And I don't think anybody would argue that it was a fast-paced environment. But it was a different, even though it was fast-paced, it was fast-paced activity. But sometimes the decision-making was really stretched out.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Whereas the, you know, it's, it, if you, I was studying some stuff from the special forces, and somebody, you know, they once said that their rule of thumb is the best decision is the right decision. The next best decision is the wrong decision. And the worst thing you can do is no decision.
That's very true. Yeah.
You will not. They're like, that is the one thing that sure, when you're in a firefight, you will die if you make no decision.
That's
And I think that, you know, obviously it's not truly life or death, but I think that corresponds and carries over on that continuum much more so into entrepreneurship, which is you just have to make the decision.
That's right. That's right. You know, it's being an engineer and working on, you know, multi-generation product plans, right? MGPPs.
Yep.
And, you know, it was kind of one of those things where the terminology was launch, learn, and relaunch, right? So number one, the first word is launch, which means you do something, yes, right? And then you learn, basically, was it the right move to your point, right? The first move is right. The second move is probably wrong, right?
Yep.
But you learn, and then you relaunch, right? You launch, learn, and relaunch. And that's kind of how, especially in entrepreneurship, is how you have to be. You know, you're not always going to be right. Be thoughtful and intentional about the launch and what you're going after and the opportunity you're going after. But understand that you're going to have to learn along the way. But no decision is also a decision, you know, and especially, you know, in entrepreneurship. I mean, because your competition will pass you up. You're not innovating fast enough. You're not acquiring clients fast enough. Somebody else is, you know, so that lack of decision really can have a negative impact. It's not like in the military, right, where you die, but it can definitely have a detrimental impact on your business.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Your business will. Right.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. So quick question for you, right? As looking at your career, you were a very competitive athlete early on, right? In high school and then in college and whatnot. And I look at how, and as I've had a chance to talk to a variety of people, one of the things that I've noticed is typically competitive athletes on team sports tend to look at the world and adapt differently to the business world than either the individual athletes. So like I was a wrestler, right? And so I looked at it from a certain perspective, but I wasn't, you know, I had to go score points. But if somebody else didn't do their job, it didn't reflect poorly on me. It did on the team, but it wasn't, you know, we weren't truly interlocked, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And one of the things as you were talking through this is you were able to see roles with purpose that kind of led you to the next step and to understand that. How do you think maybe your athletic background and that competition and that coaching and receiving hard feedback fed into your ability to adapt and accelerate into the corporate world and then transition into entrepreneurship?
Yeah, you know, it's you said the word team, right? So if you're, as you know, as an athlete, right, either you're in that individual sport or you're in that team sport. And what really translated for me, I played team sports, you know, throughout my, you know, athletic career. And although I play an individual sport now, which is golf, we'll talk about that later. But, but that team sport, that team dynamic was crucial, yeah. Right? It was crucial as far as, number one, knowing what your job was and executing on what you had to do, but then also, you know, being able to pull everybody and rally everybody around the goal, which was to win, right? And it's similar especially in a corporate capacity. It's similar to where you know, they'll use words like culture, right? They'll use words like team player, you know. So they'll use those kind of words in corporate America, but what they're looking for is somebody to, you know, have an impact, get things done, but then also have the ability and the empathy, you know, to really connect with other people, their other teammates, because it really pulls everybody forward, and you get to a win, right? So it's similar to that in corporate America. What I would say in entrepreneurship as well, you know, because you can't do it by yourself. Right. So even in entrepreneurship, you may have the right idea. It may be your idea and you bootstrap it a little bit. You kind of get it going. You get some traction. Eventually you're going to build a team, and that team, it comes back to that word team. Right. So all of that experience really kind of lends itself to, you know, building the right team around you. When you're an entrepreneur, hiring the right people, knowing what kind of people, you know, would better fit the team, your company, what you're doing, because it matters, right? A lot of corporate, one of the things I will say, I see between, when it comes to team, between corporate America and entrepreneurship, is that corporate America actually gets this part of it right, better.
They do.
And here's what I mean by that, right? Because they focus on that culture. They focus on the team player. They focus on making sure that everybody is doing their part and they're moving in, you know, in that same direction in corporate America. They're actually really good at that. On the entrepreneurial side, what you will have is you'll have a great product. You'll have a great company that can really take off, right? But because that CEO or that founder or that leadership team doesn't have the right culture mindset, they're not thinking about everybody else. They're in it for themselves. You know, they're treating everybody poorly, everybody that they hire onto the team. I mean, it matters, right? So then you'll have a company that has so much potential that they're not able to realize any of that potential because either they hired the wrong team or they didn't pay enough, you know, attention to the culture that they were creating, and what the company needed to actually go forward. So I've seen it. So again, it goes back to the team. And the athletics piece of it, but then it translates all the way through corporate America as well as, you know, entrepreneurship.
And that's so well said, extremely well said. And it's funny because as I realized that shortcoming in myself and that lack of development at some point in my early to mid career, and so just spent an inordinate amount of time studying teams, right? How do they work? How does it truly play out? But the breakthrough moment for me, this is going to sound so silly, was actually coaching youth sports.
it's humbling. Yeah,
it is, right? And you're trying to get this group of kids to do something and move. And I'm not talking about like 4 and 5 year olds. I'm talking about, you know, kids that are old enough. So maybe 10 to 15 year olds, right? They're cognizant, they're aware, they know that they've got to work together in order to achieve this goal. And Ken Blanchard, I think, said it best when he was like, none of us, as in not one of us, is as good as all of us.
That's right.
And so that's one of those things that just kind of carried me, is really allowed me to catapult my career and these other things going forward, is just recognizing exactly what you just said. You can't do it on your own.
Yeah, you can't. You know, it's interesting because I coach my my 10-year-olds football team. You know, they're in their second year, I think, of tackling, and you're exactly right. I mean, number one, the kids can see the you know, when you have that empathy, when you care, and you know, you really try to get the team to move in the same direction, right? They see that, number one. Number two, I think, you know, just like you said, right? I mean, it's always about, yes, you're fast. And I'll give you a prime example. I'm coaching the running backs, right? The guys with the speed. And then the linemen, tend to be a little bit slower. Not all of them, but they tend to be a little bit slower. So, and I told the running backs, I said, hey, you have to let the play develop. Right, you have to let this guy make that block before you just ram. I know you know where the hole is, but before you just ram the hole with all your speed, let that play develop. So then it opens up, and then you can get more yards because you can have a little bit more flexibility. You can see the hole better. And because what was happening before, they would hit the hole, because he's so fast. He was like, "Well, I'm the fastest kid on the team." Yes, you are. You know, you can get there faster by yourself, but you can go further with the team, right? And you know, so yeah, you can hit that hole faster by yourself, but with the team in front of you, you can actually go further. So if you're running 50 yards, you can run 100 yards, run a touchdown, right? So it was that concept of, you know, really getting them to see that they needed the team, and it's not just that one, not just that one individual, right? Same thing in entrepreneurship, right? A lot of the companies that we look at. You know, you have a CTO or CEO or founder. They're just gung-ho, right? But they can go fast by themselves, but they can go further when they have the right team around them, because you just can't do it by yourself.
That's right. That is so well said. So, speaking of entrepreneurship, how did you make the pivot and the transition from corporate America and corporate success, where you had multiple successes built up, right? It would have been natural to just finish your career there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pull out. I mean, what happened and how did you make that decision?
So I've always thought about entrepreneurship, you know, even early on in my career. My father, you know, he owned his own cleaning business, and, you know, I decided to go be an engineer to his dismay. So I went off to engineering school, and he had the business. So I was around it. And I've always had it in the back of my mind that I wanted to do entrepreneurship. At the time when I did that part role, I didn't know what that meant. I just knew when people would ask me, what do you want to be in 20 years? Right. I knew it was somewhere in that space. I just didn't know what it was. I thought maybe I was going to be a you know, my idea at that time was to become a part supplier. Like a supply chain third tier supplier to GE. I mean, that was kind of rattling around, you know, supplying them bolts or whatever, right?
Yeah.
You know, so that was my idea. I was just waiting for the right time to do it. Now, the bolt idea didn't happen, but, you know, throughout, you know, my career progression, everything I learned now, at that time, it wouldn't have been prudent for me to do that because I didn't know anything. You know what I mean? I didn't know anything. So progressing up the ladder, running businesses, all of that really gave me the knowledge that I need to do it today, right? So so that took a while, and but then once I got there, though, you know, it was, I had already left GE. I went to a couple of different companies, had the opportunity, quite frankly, to leverage a lot of that experience that I learned in the big corporate setting, moved into the private equity environment and space, for the technology business. And that was eye opening for me. And you know what it showed me was that, number one, there are on a corporate, 500 level, obviously there's opportunity, right? B2B. But in that lower mid-market, especially private equity space, huge opportunity. I mean, huge opportunity for people to really take the experience that they have, that they learn actually from corporate America, and bring it into this space and be very, very impactful and very successful, actually. Now, I was not a cookie cutter. I will say that, right? I couldn't take the GE playbook, if you will, and just plop it into a small company. That just wouldn't work, right? Because it's a corporate structure. So you have to be able, to take bits and pieces. So I realized at that time, as I moved into, the private equity space and now into venture, there's just ample amounts of opportunity to really leverage all of that experience. So that's what really drove it, right? Was to see that first and then have an opportunity to kind of get into the space. And really, I've been doing it. Been doing it ever since.
That's fantastic. So, you made that transition into that, but you started a firm, and then you've also started a PE firm, right, and a venture firm.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
All right. Yep. How do you look at the two, and how do you think about them differently, or do they play well together?
They do not play well together. what's interesting is that venture is a subset of private equity as an asset class, right? So in theory, it's kind of in the same space. But on the PE side, what we were doing with the IoT technology business is, going into these lower mid-market companies who were manufacturing. And, we've had manufacturing for hundreds of years, and we're going to have manufacturing for hundreds of more. But if you've noticed, the manufacturing is getting smarter. Those processes are getting smarter. So that's what the IoT business was focused on, within that, in that private equity space. And all of that experience from corporate America, from GE and other places, really, lent itself well, to be able to help these companies, do that. Now, in the venture space is a little bit different, in the sense that, being a part of the leadership team of the venture firm, it's really exciting because your lens is slightly different, in a way. And what I mean by that, in private equity, you're looking for a company that's going to have good EBITDA, good operating principles, steady growth, 3, 4, 5x maybe. Type of growth. I mean, a solid company, undervalued, solid company. That's really what you're looking for. In venture, what you're looking for is high growth. And where I had to switch, because I'm an operator, and engineer, where I had to switch a little bit was, when you get into venture and it's a very high growth company, sometimes the operating principles are not quite there. And traditionally they've been focused more on growth than they have been on burn rates, what we call burn rates, reducing their costs. It's slightly different, but the returns are higher. Whereas the private equity side is 3, 4, 5, maybe 6, and venture it's 10. I mean, you underwrite to a 10, right? So it has to have that because it's a higher risk. The return obviously have to be higher. So the market has to be there, the team has to be there, the potential has to be there for them to really get to that space. So that's how it's different and how they, how they don't play well together. But I will say in the current environment, in our economic environment last year, and even coming into this year, a lot of, even the venture companies are becoming more operationally focused, and also focused on reducing that burn rate, right? Because the growth is not happening. Cost of capital is higher. The growth is just not happening, as fast as they thought. But it's starting to look up. I said at the beginning of the call, right, that, it kind of ebbs and flows, it goes up and down. But this year is really starting to, it's starting to look up. But I, and even as it looks up for some of these companies, What's really good about it is as they get into, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a full bull market, at the moment, but as they start to come out of it and grow a little bit, what's good about what's happened in the last year is that they've learned, they've exercised that operating muscle on the venture side. Whereas before they didn't, because they didn't have to. Yeah. But over the last year or so, you've got some really good companies, if they survive, right? You've got some really good companies now that can take advantage of, you know, some of this upswing that's happening. But then they have a stronger muscle when it comes to operating, reducing their cost and things like that. So, I mean, it really is starting to look up for the space.
I like that. And I like the way you're talking about it from that perspective. So question for you, when you think about balancing purpose, impact and profitability within these portfolios and in your investments and things like that, how does all that play out?
Well, profitability is first, right? In the asset class, that's just the name of the game. In our view, we look at profitability as table stakes, right? So, you just set that aside.
Actually, before you set that aside, there's a huge contingent of folks that would say, no, purpose is number one. It's always number one.
Well,
I'd say profitability is number one. Most of our audience goes, Macaulay, what kind of question is that? Everybody knows, right?
Well, it depends on how you look at it, like you said, right? It depends on how you look at it. Well, we're not. I can't speak for everybody, but what I can say is that, you know, we're not concessionary, right? So we are for profit. We're not concessionary. We do have an impact and purpose stronger lens, but, you know, it's got to be profitable, right? For our investors, you still have to have that return. And we focus on that, right? We do our underwriting to that. But then, you know, we also look at where is it happening, right? Because it can continue to happen in the areas and regions of the world, quite frankly, that they've always happened, and they will continue to happen. But there's an untapped market in some other areas that may not have seen capital before, right? So that there's an opportunity there. Remember, I talked about seeing the gap, seeing the opportunity, going after that opportunity at the beginning of the call. Right. So it's in a similar way, it's in that fashion where we're looking at, are they making an impact in their community? Is it a water situation? Is it a, you know, sort of a smart city solution situation? Is it a climate situation? Which, by the way, when we talk to, you know, companies, in our view, every company is a climate company. No matter what you're doing, I don't care if you're making bolts, there's a better way to make that bolt, right? So when you think about it in that way, I'm reducing my energy consumption, which is going to reduce your energy bill. It's related, right? So we look at the impact that they're making, the jobs that they're creating, from an impact perspective, and then purpose. You know, it's really around going after those areas that haven't seen that capital before. And now it's not that they couldn't do it. They just weren't given the opportunity to do it. Right. And that's where you really start to see, some of the outsized returns that a lot of the investors are looking for in those untapped areas. We have a saying in our ecosystem where if the herd is going here, then find something over there. Right. Because generally, if you're investing or moving with the herd, you're late, right? You're late. You're not going to see that 10X. You're not going to see, that what they call a power factor, right? If you remember in the GE days, the whole Pareto principle, right? The whole Pareto chart, right?
Yeah.
The Pareto chart is essentially from Pareto, the guy. It's 80-20 rule. Right. So that, how do you find that 20%? You're not going to find that 20% that's creating that 80% of that outsized return just by following the herd. You're going to find it in areas that have opportunity that's just untapped. So that's kind of how we, how we approach it. And usually those areas are purpose focused areas, right? Whether it's, somebody trying to, change the environment, somebody who's trying to change their community, somebody who's trying to create jobs, somebody who's, you know, trying to clean up their water supply in their community, in their system. We look for all of those things. And that really comes into, you know, how we look at purpose and impact and profitability. But like I said, I mean, profitability has to be there. And that's what we look for.
That makes a ton of sense. So would you just share a couple of insights, right? When you're looking at businesses, how you look at aligning their values with the investments that of the investors that you're representing, right? And making sure that this all lines up. So you were talking about it from a purpose standpoint. Mm-hmm. Right? Let's drill down, double click on it, go a little bit further. How does that actually play out when you're making that investment and you're deciding to make an investment?
Well, you know, it plays out in the sense of when we identify the company, and if it is a company that we're looking, if it's on thesis, we call it on thesis, meaning it has the right focus, you know, the purpose and intent. We bring it in, and we bring it into an investment committee. So they would already have to have either a leadership team that is coming together, and they're pulling together the people from the communities that they're trying to serve, or they're training people in the communities that they're trying to serve, if those people are not ready for those leadership positions, right? So we look for those kind of things coming in, and we bring that into our investment committee. And we have a conversation around it. Now, not all investors are on, you know, each investment committee, but the investors who have specific expertise, if you will, or know a specific geography, we will tap them and say, hey, we're looking at this opportunity. This is the team. This is a solution that they're driving. This is the market potential. This is the opportunity. This is the impact that they're making. And then we'll get input from that particular investor to go into the investment committee. And we make our decision based on that. Now, after the decision, there's a measurement piece of it, right? So at the end of it, you know, when we do, not only do we check periodically, did you hit your milestones? You know, how's your revenue doing? How's your burn rate? All that stuff. But in addition to capturing all that information on a periodic basis from a metric standpoint, we look at their impact, right? So, you know, you said you were going to make an impact in this community by doing this. Your revenue went up 20%. What was the impact on the community? You said you were going to train this group of people or this person to help them get better after you brought them on board. Did that happen, right? So we have a compliance person, a platform person, they call it, to really track all of those across the portfolios and basically feed that up. Because you will have some investors that will ask at a portfolio level, not just one particular company level, but they'll ask at a portfolio level, you know, so how you doing, right? How you doing on your metrics, whether it's greenhouse gas reduction, you know, whether it's, you know, underrepresented areas, whether it's, you know, climate change, all of that kind of comes into play where we have to report out to some of our investors and we keep that at a high level. So that's how it translates, right? So that's how it translates from finding a company, a founder, or a team, sort of assessing kind of where they are. Do they fit the thesis already? And then tracking to how they're actually performing against that thesis.
That's fantastic. All right. So as we're wrapping up real quick, first off, thank you. Really appreciate this. This has been powerful. Lots of insights. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that? Is it LinkedIn? Is it email?
It is not LinkedIn. You know, LinkedIn is pretty, you get inundated with a lot of, I go to a lot of events, I meet a lot of people. And of course, you know, the easy way is to connect on LinkedIn. So I see a lot of them, but I don't respond to a lot of them. But, you know, if somebody wants to get in touch, email is probably better. Infernal@ehicleantech.com. And that's usually the best way. Because when the emails come in, I mean, I do have my standard work. I mean, I still kept the standard work piece from GE. As it's coming in, I do prioritize on, you know, what's happening and who's trying to reach out.
Perfect. That's great. If you've got folks that are in the audience that are, they have a firm that they've started up and they're looking for venture funding or something like that, would you, and they're on point, what's the core criteria that you have if you wanted to, if they wanted to reach out to you, just say, hey, if you don't check these three boxes, don't reach out. But if you do check these three boxes, absolutely.
Yeah. You know what? That's a good question. Number one, for us to make an investment, right? I mean, like I said, it has to be on thesis, which is in the climate space, clean energy and climate space. That's number one. Number two, you know, we do primarily seed plus to Series A. And what that means is you're past your product market fit. You've got clients, you've got revenue, and you're actually starting to scale or you're already scaling, but you're looking for new geographies to try to accelerate that. That's where our value is, right? So if you're a founder who is in that particular sweet spot, then definitely reach out. That's where we're having investment conversations. Now that being said, I do go to a lot of events, like I mentioned, and I do have people that'll just reach out, and I'm curious. I'm curious about the technology, so I'll get some earlier stage, companies that are not quite there on the revenue side, but they're getting there, you know. And if I think it's a if I think it's a great, interesting founder, if I think they're developing the right team, they have a good product, I will keep in touch with them. I'll give them advice, you know, along the way. Hey, you might want to think about this. You might want to think about that. I can't tell you the number one on one requests I get from people saying, hey, I just want to bounce something off of you. So I do that as well. Even for companies that we don't invest in, I'll do that, because if it's a company that's up and coming and developing, when you do get that revenue and you're starting to churn and you're humming, if you're doing really well as a founder, you actually can decide on who you want on your cap table, right? So there's a lot of capital out there, but there's a lot of money, but there's also a lot of bad money, right? That's out there. So you want to be cognizant of who your investors are. But I think having that relationship prior to you actually needing it, or before you actually hitting that particular milestone, really helps. So I will do that. I'll do both. Even though we don't make an investment today, if I think the company is definitely something that's on thesis and very interesting, I will, stay in touch. We'll have one-on-ones. I'll kind of watch and kind of, see if you're hitting your milestones, and we just kind of go from there.
I like it. So we'll put this in the description as well, your contact info, but it's M. Purnell, is it Mike Purnell, at ehicleantech.com.
Correct.
Perfect. All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been great catching up, and looking forward to connecting with you again soon.
Yep. Thanks, Mike. Enjoyed it.